Welcome to PCMC, Pop Culture Man Children. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm here today with my good friend and yours, Mr. Peter Marsh. Pete, how are you?
Yes. Mike, I'm a little worried about how excited I am to talk about both of our movies in these two recordings today. Like, I feel like I should have this much excitement about, like, my career and education
No,
or,
no.
like, yeah.
That's so funny. No, it's funny. This episode and then the one we're recording for next week. This episode today is about Dark City from 1999, which is a kind of heady movie, but next week you'll see what we're talking about. But both I thought like, oh, this won't be like too like in the weeds. And I found myself getting very theoretical when making notes and thinking about these movies. So you have to stay tuned. People are like, oh, are they doing Citizen Kane next week? What are they doing? No, even better.
Right. I was going to make a joke of like the movie we're covering is better than Citizen Kane. So,
gun to my head, what do you want to watch right now? I might watch the movie we're watching. But all right, we've teased that enough. Today we're talking about Dark City from 1998. This is directed by Alex Proyas. We just did an episode on PCMC for the original Crow. Me and Bill did it. The screenplay is by Alex Proyas, Lem Dobbs, and David S. Goyer. He's got a very, I don't know, I was going to say troubled history, but no, he's done a lot of stuff. The cinematographer is Darius Wolski. The production designers are George Little, Patrick Tatopoulos, and the composer is Trevor Jones. I usually don't go, I'm inconsistent with this. Movies are, I'm not an auteurist. Like, movies are like a group effort. But sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't say, like, the cinematographer and stuff. And it's usually, I should always say it or never say it, but I usually say it when, like, it really stands out. And Dark City, if you're not familiar with it, is a movie that has an incredible look to it. It has incredible texture to it, great music, great everything. It's really a sort of genre meditation, or using genre to meditate about philosophy or whatever. Peter, what's your history with Dark City?
I think I saw it on VHS. I don't think I saw it in the theater.
Wow.
And I think that I saw the trailers for it, and I was very intrigued by how it looked. I had seen The Crow. I knew about Alex Proyas, and you know, when this movie came out in 1998, I'm probably about like 16 years old, maybe 15 at this point. And the idea of like a filmmaker that has like a unique vision was like really, really exciting for me at that point in my life. You know, I'm like, oh, this is something different. This looks different. And I think at that point, and this I think still is applicable today, I think sometimes style over substance is more important to me. Like just how a movie looks can sometimes be more important than the message in it. Yeah.
I think that that's a really interesting thing. I think that so people say style over substance, usually they mean that as an insult, meaning the movie, all the movie cared about is how it looked. And I think that's possible. I think there are things that look really good that aren't good. But then there are things where style is substance. It's like whenever I teach film, I'm always trying to keep them, because students and normal people, I think, always want to talk about story and narrative because that's how they think about films. So it's always a struggle to get them out of that mindset and to think about the sort of formative elements of what makes a movie, the way it looks, the way the camera moves, the way the sound is used, the way costume and makeup is used. But then the next struggle, it's sort of the second half of the class, is to tell them that it, even though I've pulled them away from story and narrative, that it's the same thing. It's like, you know, when we're talking about all of those formative elements, it's like talking about grammar and vocabulary. Like, style is substance. Like, it's not like it's a container and then the container is the style and then inside is the narrative, inside is the substance. It's what's expressing it. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it's funny because, like, You and I go like real deep, real quick. It sounds very sexual, but like we
That's
do,
what
like
she
right away.
said.
Right, exactly. And so we go that way, and I'm like, oh, this probably just like turns people off immediately. They're like, what are they even fucking talking about? Like, talk about the story. But like, I just love talking philosophically with you. And you know, when I was into movies at this point in my life, when I was a teenager, I remember I read like Wizard magazine and comics, you know, and they would talk about comics all the time, right? And I remember there was like one question that at the time I didn't agree with the answer. They posed this question to the readers: what's more important, the artist that makes the comic book or the writer that makes the comic book, right? And in my mind, I'm like, of course it's the fucking writer. Like, they're making the story. That's why I read these things, is because of the story. But as I've gotten older, I realize that like good art in a comic can make up for like any kind of lackluster story. And I'm sorry to like hijack your show and just keep talking. Kind of reminds
No,
me of one
but
of
it
my
is
co-hosts.
story. Good art is story.
Yeah.
Like they're not a separate thing. That's the thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah. And like and I think like an example that has come up recently that I keep thinking about, because there's a trailer out for Tron Ares, right? And it makes me think of Tron Legacy. And I don't really think Tron Legacy is a good movie, but like filmmaking, like you just said, is a collaboration between so many different people. The visuals in that movie are so good, and the music is like, it has one of the best scores of any movie ever. And so like I always get intrigued by that movie because I'm like, I know it's not as good as the stuff I really enjoy, but I just love looking at it and listening to it.
Well, to continue on a digression, I was having this conversation with Janine from the show about Tron Ares, because isn't that the whole fucking series? I mean, even the original Tron, right? Like she was like, "What do you think of this movie?" I was like, "I think it's gonna be visually fascinating. I think it's gonna have philosophical ideas, and I think it's gonna be a story that's boring and not good," which is the Tron. That itself is the Tron legacy, right? Tron movies look great. They've got bigger ideas boiling under the surface if you want to get there, but they're typically boring and a slog to get through.
Yes, exactly. And I kind of thought that Dark City was going to be that, because I remember that like Alex Proyas has this like vision. He's able to bring the team together to make something that's like visually exciting. And he kind of reminds me of Guillermo del Toro too, where like Guillermo del Toro, he absolutely has a vision. When you see his stuff, you're always like just in wonder and awe of what you're watching, but you can always kind of feel like, oh, it's like a little bit, the quality of the dialogue or the pacing, it's not exactly where I want it to be, but it's still like really satisfying to watch. And so I feel that way about Alex Proyas in general. The real diamond of a movie, the real like exceptional movie, is where every single thing is on the same level,
Interesting.
you know. And I think the movie we're talking about next week, it is that. And I think like the movies that like everyone always references and quotes and stuff are that. But this movie, it's pretty damn close though.
But
The dialogue is sharp in this. Oh, go ahead.
I like bad movies. I like all kinds of movies. Like
Yeah.
a movie's equal more than the sum of their parts. There are
Right.
movies that I love, genuinely love, and see great value in that I know have real flaws. You know, it's the gestalt of it. It's how does it all work together? But you know, bouncing off of Tron, I think is a good way to actually get into this, because Dark City comes out in 1998, and it's often put together with Existenz and The Matrix as this time in the late last millennium when we were thinking about like virtual reality and illusions. But this one gets at it in a different way than those two. Those two are very more the Existenz and The Matrix are very like almost literal in the idea of like, oh, you're in an illusion, where this is a little bit more of a metaphor. So if you don't know anything about this movie, it plays out like a film noir from the late 40s. It's got very film noir music. It's got low key lighting, like film noir. It's everyone's wearing like early 50s, late 40s clothing, and guys have fedoras and ties and old cars. And it goes, and a lot of those film noirs were like detective stories or at least mystery stories. And this one begins that way. It is a guy who wakes up in a bathtub and he's like, "Where am I? What am I doing? There's a dead body there." He doesn't know what it is. Immediately, I thought of the game BioShock. And then I was like, there has to be a connection. And I looked it up, and the creator of BioShock said he absolutely was inspired by Dark City. And the first, I'd say the first third of this movie plays out like a mystery of, does this guy have amnesia? Is he a killer? People are after him. Is he really a murderer? What's going on? Is somebody framing him? And then that sort of genre engine, let's say, kind of stops, and it becomes this other thing of, no, in fact, it's not really a mystery in that sense. It's a thing of, and I will give it all away right now. That's fine. We're talking about it. Dark City is an experiment. It's actually in outer, we eventually see at the end, it's in outer space. It's like, it looks like a like disc world. Like it's just a disc city in outer space that's being run by these aliens that they call the Strangers, that are all these like men with like, well, actually men and women and children with like super white faces and bald heads, and they wear like fedoras and like black. They look a little bit like Cenobites when they're in their own little area, but then when they're out in the world, they have like, you know, trench coats and stuff. And they are doing this experiment, which we could get into what they're actually trying to figure out, where they've got all these humans living in this city, and there's really no daytime. It's just constantly night. And every night at midnight, they put everyone to sleep. It's so, even just describing it feels like a fable. They put everyone to sleep, and then they come out and they rearrange things, like literally, like they make this building taller and they move that bridge, and they take these poor people and they give them a beautiful house, and now they're rich people. And they have a sort of mad scientist doctor with them who's a human that they have working for them, who actually goes and steals people's memories and injects them into other people's minds. So they're swapping people's memories and therefore personalities around. And that's what's happening with this guy. He was mid about to be swapped, but he woke up and he kind of doesn't, he kind of has a little bit of the memories of that they were trying to implant in him, but he's not a killer. And then it becomes something, you know, it's something like that. I think I did justice explaining it.
No, yeah, you did 1,000%.
Yeah, so there's so much to get into. What do you think about the Strangers?
That's the selling point. That's the whole, that's the main thing you remember from this movie. You might remember the set design and the cinematography, the way it looks, but they are such a crucial part of the look, and the most exciting shots in the movie involve them, right?
Was shot?
It's like the most exciting like shots. Like, you know, I've already kind of talked about comic books, and a lot of this looks like comic book panels. And the most exciting like panels or shots are shots that have the strangers in them.
I was just watching, Roger Ebert was a huge proponent of this movie. He's actually, I haven't, I listened to this like 10 years ago. On the Blu-ray, he, when he was alive, Ebert did an audio commentary,
Oh, that's
like
cool.
just talking about what he thinks is great about it and like coming up with theories on how you can read it and stuff. Ebert actually has a really interesting theory that I want to get to later. But I was watching him on like the Siskel and Ebert show, and he was saying that when he watched it, he thought it was an adaptation of a comic book and then looked it up later and was surprised to find it wasn't, which is such an interesting thing because we know we now live in a world inundated with superhero movies. So it's kind of like, what does comic book mean? But you're right, it is so visually arresting. One of the main strangers that we see is played by Richard O'Brien, who created Rocky Horror Picture Show. He plays Riff Raff in Rocky Horror Picture Show. So he's perfect. He always plays I think he's also in the original Dungeons and Dragons movie. He always plays like a bald, weirdo, scary guy. And he's like the main stranger in this. All the strangers have very simple noun names. He's Mr. Hand, and then the leader seems to be someone named Mr. Book. We should say that there's two versions of this movie. There's a director's cut and then the theatrical version. The theatrical version, there are changes made because they assumed the audience was dumb. So in the theatrical version, it begins, this is similar to Blade Runner, with a monologue basically giving the entire game away. Like, if you watch the theatrical, it's still a good movie, but the theatrical version is like, anyway, there's these people called strangers and they control us and they change them, blah, 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 blah. They just give the entire thing away. Whereas if you watch a director's cut, which I wish I had watched that first, because you would really not know what's happening until the big reveal, like towards the very end.
Look, I want to ask you a question, Mike. Have you ever watched a movie where you were confused, you didn't know what was going on, and that didn't make you want to watch the movie again, or like didn't make you super invested in the movie? Has that ever happened to you where actually not knowing what's going on confused you so much where you're just like, oh, fuck this, I don't care? Has that ever happened to you?
That's a great question. I've never had this experience where the not knowing what's going on turned me off, and therefore I was like, I don't want to know more. But being that I watch a lot of shit from, all over and whenever, sometimes sometimes it's baked into what it's doing is that it's trying to be confusing. And there are things that I watch and I go, okay, this is filled with riddles, or this is begging to be read. But I don't have the energy right there to do it. And I'm kind of like, okay, I got it. Like, it's kind of like looking at a puzzle and appreciating it and then being like, yeah, but I don't really want to solve it. That happens to me all the time. Like, I'll watch, like, and some old, French New Wave movie. And I'm like, I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I know they're doing something. And I probably could go, like, find a Reddit thread about it, or I could go find some academic paper about it. But I'm fine with not knowing.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like abstract movies where I haven't like wanted to go look it up or like look up information about it to get the answers, where I just kind of I'm like, okay, that was weird. I'm good with it, like you just said. But I think as long as a movie, all the components that make it, everything that goes into the recipe to bake it, I think as long as they're all strong, I don't care if I'm confused and don't know what's going on, or if I don't even know what's going on by the end of the movie. Like, I'm just satisfied by it. Like, I'm just bringing this up because I think of Blade Runner, which you just mentioned, which has that narration that was added. Then I think of David Lynch's Dune, where like that doesn't have a narration, but there's like you hear what people are thinking in their head, right? And then I know that like when Dune came out, the David Lynch version, they gave out these like pamphlets that explained the world, like this is what the spice does, and this happened, right? And it's funny because that's something that has never gone away. It's always existed in Hollywood. And I think we have like the worst case scenario with it nowadays where they won't even make a movie like this because they're afraid that like audiences only want to see things that they already know and have already seen before. So they don't take risks on movies like this.
No, if this movie were made now, it would be like a Netflix movie or a Netflix series. It would never make it theatrically. But going on what you said, I wonder though if this movie would be even more powerful if there was no explanation. All right, take out the opening monologue. In the director's cut, there's a scene towards like the very like end where the character played by Kiefer Sutherland, who's like the mad scientist, he kind of explains everything to the late main character. I was thinking, if you take that out, right, then it's like a David Lynch film, right? It's the exact same film, but you take out any kind of explanation. I wonder if people would be talking about it still more. If it, if nothing were spoon-fed to you, if you were really challenged to try to find out everything.
Yeah, that's a really great point. It's funny. I think the thing that you and I talk about the most besides The Last Jedi and Star Wars is David Lynch, right? And it's funny because there's certain movies that people just as film goers accept that they're not going to know what's going on, and they're kind of
Yeah.
like, I don't know what's going to happen in this, or like I didn't understand it, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to sci-fi, they're not as forgiving. Like they get, when it's a genre thing,
Yeah, that's
they're
interesting.
not as forgiving. Yeah, because
No,
I
that
think
makes a lot of
boy,
sense. Yeah.
I got like metaphors up the ass, today, but like, I think of like fiction in general, right? Like I think that like movies that are just kind of dramas are like fiction basically, or like literature, and then like there's definitely genre movies that people they know they're going to see a specific genre, so they're excited about that genre. And I think that they're not forgiving if they don't know all the answers by the end.
That's interesting. Yeah, it also speaks to the fandom of different types of genre.
Yeah, like because I think that this movie, it's in that sci-fi genre. Well, I mean, at one point I wanted to make too was I think that the genesis of this movie, I'm not Alex Proyas, so I can't say if this is the case or not, but I think from what I've read that like he wanted to make like a noir type movie, like a fantasy noir sci-fi movie, and I know he wanted to make it be scary and unsettling, like have
Yeah.
horror elements in it too. And I think that that's probably the very starting point is that of like, I want it to be this genre. I want it to feel this way. And
Yeah.
then the plot and the sort of like the Matrix type feeling of this is all fabrication. I think that's probably step two versus like step one, you know?
No, yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like most stories, I think when they're generated, people are like, it's a what if. What if I had superpowers, or like, what if I got roped into like some kind of bank heist, but I didn't want to, or like, what if these people took over this building? Like all these different like what if scenarios. I don't think that that's where Dark City starts. I think Dark City starts with, oh, I see this image in my head. Now let me come up with a cool plot to go along with this image.
Well, that we okay, so that leads me to want to talk about Roger Ebert's theory, which is the
Go ahead.
way Roger Ebert read the film is as a metaphor for Hollywood, and the strangers being a metaphor and of like these European people who came over and like which run these studios. And like the strangers are like the producers and the studio heads, and Dark City is like the set. And he sort of is like a metaphor for how Hollywood creates realities, but also Hollywood in a sense creates the media in a sense creates our reality. Like I'm big when I was in grad school, like I was big into like Marxist theory and apparatus theories, the idea that the culture we live in is sort of informed by our media because the media is part of the system, so it's part of the capitalist system. It's a business, it's there to make money. But it also creates versions of reality. Like people, so like the simple thing that people think about is that like, oh, like media will affect you. It'll brainwash you. Like if you play a violent video game, you'll want to act violently. But what we found is that's not how the media affects us, but the media does affect us very deeply. It's more that the media defines the world for us. You know, a theorist named George Gerbner came with what he called cultivation theory, which is that if you have something repeated to you over and over and over again, you'll just accept that as the truth.
Sure.
You like violent media doesn't make us act violently. It just makes us think the world is more violent than it might be. You know, if you
That's
watch
it.
Law and
Okay.
Order and that's the only time you've ever seen New York, you'll assume New York is a place where you go to get murdered or sexually assaulted, right?
Right, right.
If the only time, if you know, you don't know people of different ethnicities other than like the stereotype visions of them in movies and TV, that will be your definition for them. So bring that all back. The metaphor would serve to be like the strangers that are creating this reality and constantly recreating and reconstructing it, but still basically getting back to the same idea of this is what reality looks like. And genre is a way of understanding that. I mean, the reason genre is popular is the same reason that now, like, reboots are popular and sequels are popular, which is that it's giving you something you know you already like. It's like Coca-Cola. You know, like
Yes.
Hollywood really started leaning into genre very early in the golden age with like westerns and musicals, because they know these movies sold well, so let's just make more of them. So
Right.
with genre comes a prepackaged ideology. This is the way things work in the genre. This is like, you know what you're gonna get when you watch a genre film. That's why I think what's interesting in
Yes.
this movie is
Yeah.
it's a genre film that almost falls apart in the middle. Like, if you were a real genre, like noir fan, I could see you being disappointed when you realize that the mystery you've been thinking about is pointless, that there isn't a
Yeah.
real murderer, that it's not a, like it, like I could see some people like, oh, what, there's fucking aliens? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
Yeah.
it really lead half, you know, halfway through or whatever, it sort of kind of says like, oh, you've been on the wrong track. Like, you, the viewer, are on the wrong track of trying to figure this out.
It's funny, right? I think that the M for my last name today stands for metaphor, right? Because I think like genre is like a restaurant, right? I don't know, like in your own kitchen that you can make any kind of food, but when you go to a specific restaurant, you're like, oh, I'm going to a Chinese restaurant. You kind of think that the decor is going to be a certain way, the food's going to be a certain way, the portions and everything. That's the way genre is. It's like, what am I feeling tonight? Oh, I'm feeling Chinese. I'm feeling Italian, right? And that's why, you're like, oh, I want sci-fi. I think that when they advertise Dark City and when people had interest and want to see it, like myself included, you knew there was something more to it than just like some kind of mystery and these creepy people. You knew that there was going to be some kind of deeper thing. It kind of right away, because like with the strangers themselves, like they show that they can like put people to sleep pretty quickly. It's like maybe within the first 10 minutes or so, and everyone falls asleep. I think in the trailer they show like a stranger go
Oh,
like
I'm sure they
this
gave it all
to a
away.
person and then they pass out. Right. But like, if it was just like a noir, or even if it was just horror, then that would be it. But then all of a sudden they're like flying through the air, and like then we see their like lair pretty early on too, and you're like, oh, there's something much more to this. So, at least like in the experience of the movie, you know pretty early on it's much more than just like this murder mystery
Sure,
noir
that's
framework, right? But I wanted to go back to that really great point you made about how like movies kind of reinforce your beliefs, or like that they might be like almost like a lens or like a mirror to your thoughts about something, or they make your
It's like
thoughts
a
be a certain
fake
way.
mirror. It's a mirror that shows you an illusion.
Right. What I was gonna say is that like, I grew up in New York. I lived there till I was 26, and my perception of Texas was pretty much based on film and like books and comics and stuff. And so I looked at Texas a certain way, and now I've lived here, I'm 42. Like I look at Texas in a much different way than I did growing up. I thought that it was all like kind of like sheriffs driving down back roads, and there being like some kind of store or something like once every 40 miles. There's definitely parts of Texas like that, but where I'm sitting right now, it's like the suburban area, and it's not that different from New Jersey where I am right here, but yeah, like movies definitely make you think a certain thing or feel a certain way. I don't know if the person that had the interest to go see this movie though would have been like, oh, this is a totally different thing. It's not like From Dusk Till Dawn or Sinners where it's like it feels like one kind of movie and then all of a sudden it becomes a different movie. I feel like pretty early on. Like I was going to ask you a question of, did you, when you first started watching it, did you ever think where the people live is our world and maybe there's just like creepy creatures that have come to this particular city? Or did you think of it like this is a different world altogether, this is like Gotham City or something?
I think when I first watched it, I didn't think it was, I think the I think it was the former. Like, I think I thought like, oh, this, there's something weird going on. I thought like, maybe this really is the 50s on Earth, and these weird people came and started fucking around with things. That was my
Right.
original thought. I didn't realize, I didn't think there was in space and stuff. Something
Yeah.
else that they give away that I really wish they hadn't is, there's a point where like, it's a cool effect too, where like one of the strangers gets like his head cut, and this like weird like it's almost like a Dalek, like what's inside of a Dalek, like this octopus creature comes out, and then later on you see inside one of the other strangers, and you see one, and you realize like, that's what they really are, and they're just hijacking dead bodies. I think it would have been cooler to not have that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's definitely like, they're part of a hive mind and they're these sort of like creatures. Like, it's one of those situations where when you see this kind of creature, you're like, well, how could they travel through space and stuff? They're just these fucking worm things with teeth, right? But then you realize like they are like parasites that can live inside of something, and that's how they would make technology that they use, right? But this movie definitely feels like way more magical than your typical sci-fi movie.
No, for sure. For sure. Just like the thing of like they put you to sleep and then you see everyone asleep, you know, like it feels very like fairy tale-esque.
Right. You mentioned effects like a second ago, and I was going to say to you, did you kind of have the same feeling as me where visually the on-set stuff, the production design and stuff, everything's amazing. The way the set looks, the costume design, the look of the strangers, like their world is beautiful and exciting, but then like the visual effects, the CGI and stuff is like very, very dated.
Oh, for sure. So the practical stuff looks great. And I think the movie has a very fake look, but I think that's on purpose. So did The Crow. It feels very stylized. Like I realized like in some shots of the city, they're using a lot of miniatures. There's also a shot like underneath the like underground in like the world, the subterranean world of the strangers, where like I could swear they're like little dolls or action figures that are like moving like on a line, and I love that. I feel, I mean, I don't know. This is just a personal thing with me. I love facade. I love artifice like that. Like one of my favorite things is like when you go to a dark ride and like you see like a fake night sky. Actually, when I was looking at the shots of the city, it reminded me of have you I don't have you ever been to Disney World or Disneyland?
I have not, no.
Okay. So the dark ride for Peter Pan, there's a scene in the ride where you are going over, you're flying over London like them to Never Neverland. So like you're on a track that's actually like hanging from the ceiling, and this is like an old ride. And beneath you is just a miniature of London, and that's what it reminded me of, like that weird surreal, like uncanny, like it looks like the thing, but I know it's not really that thing. And for this film, that works so well.
Like it's definitely got this sort of like Tim Burton 1989 Batman feeling,
Yes.
right?
Oh, I totally feel that.
It like I think Tim Burton, he was kind of on his, because I don't really enjoy Tim Burton films now, right? And I haven't for like a really long time, like decades at this
Yeah,
point.
me too.
And I think he was kind of, if his thing is like an arc, he's kind of going downward by this point in his career in 1998. But I know that like someone that like 1989 Batman just like blew my mind, kind of like made my character be a certain way. I think that like seeing a movie like this advertised, I was like, oh, like I'm give me this, I'm ready for this. It's got that kind of feeling. Like I think of filmmakers from that time, and I think of like Guillermo del Toro, who was like he was almost there to where he was becoming like known by people like us, right? He had made his like Mexican films and stuff, but then I don't think Blade 2 had come out yet. I think maybe Mimic had come out by the time of this movie. Then there's that French filmmaker who made like City of Lost Children. He made Alien Resurrection.
Amelie.
Yeah, they're kind of like around the same time. There's the original director of the first Blade. There's all these kind of like visually exciting directors, and they were allowed to make fairly big budget movies that were just like out there and weird. It was a great time. I kind of think of like Luc Besson a little bit too. A lot of these people are like foreign directors, and even Alex Proyas himself is a foreign director too. He's from Australia, right? Like he was born in Egypt. But then like he moved to Australia when he was like three, so he's pretty much like an Australian guy, right? And I think that that's just so exciting to a film viewer because it's usually like so different than what you expect from America, you know?
This will come up also when we talk about our film for next week. I think foreign filmmakers make amazing American films
Yep.
because the sort of ideological hegemony of Hollywood is everywhere. I mean, if you know movies, no matter where you live, you know American movies and you know Hollywood movies. But also,
Right.
you have this outsider perspective on things.
Right.
Did you,
Yep.
at any
Good.
point when thinking about this movie or reading about it, did you come across what supposedly inspired this movie from Alex Proyas? It's on IMDb trivia, which again is not a source that we could totally believe.
Right.
So yeah.
I don't know the source. If I had to guess, I would think like maybe Metropolis is one of the influences, but
Oh,
I'm
for
probably
sure.
wrong.
No, for sure, Metropolis is. So
Before you tell me
yeah.
what the sources are for it, I also want to make sure that we put a little pin in because I want to talk about what I think this is inspired to,
Oh,
you know?
sure, for sure.
Yeah.
According to IMDb, which is supposedly quoting Alex Proyas, he said that he was on the set of The Crow and the production crew was moving the set around. And so he was just standing there and he saw like the buildings move and stuff. And he had this idea of like, oh shit, like imagine like you were in a city and it was coming apart like this and moving. And
Yeah.
supposedly that's where he got the idea. Because I think of all the striking visuals in this movie, that stuff is the most interesting. And we haven't used the word yet. The strangers call it tuning, which that alone I really want to think about because it's such an interesting word because you tune an instrument, right? You
Yeah.
tune a piano. So they don't call it morphing or rearrange. They call it tuning, which I think is such an interesting like verb to use for what they do. And that's the most interesting visuals when they're tuning, when they're making this building bigger and they're changing the shape of this building and they're changing the landscape. The idea that they're actually physically changing the world that these people live in, and somehow that's going to change whatever their experiment is.
Yeah, well, I gotta tell you, the second time I watched this, I've only seen this movie once, right? And then the second time I watched it was for your show. And, I think we could talk about any kind of adult thing, but like, I was high when I watched this movie the second time, right?
Yeah.
And boy, can I tell you that like, watching this movie while high, you just become a fucking philosopher and you're like, oh my God, they're bending reality and we can do this. We can tune too. We just do it in a much more subtle way. It's not as literal as it is in this. And it's such a like exciting thing to watch when your mind is just going like free like that.
Sure, yeah.
You talked about before how like Roger Ebert thought that this movie was a metaphor for like, I guess like European producers and American filmmakers. I think that this movie is exactly what you said before, where Alex Proyas was making The Crow with these amazing sets, but sets that you could only make with the technology and the film techniques of that time. And
Yeah.
so, like, let's rearrange it. And then that kind of gave birth to this story. I think that, like, the deeper stuff that you read into this is like an after effect. It's just kind of like he's made this artwork, he's put it out there. And now you get to use your imagination and go deeper with it. Like for you to say like, oh, the tuning, it's so interesting because it's like he's comparing it to a music, to music versus like say morphing or
Yeah.
painting or whatever. I think that tuning, I feel like that's probably just something where like they're like, well, we gotta have a cool word for their power, and then they came up with that. I don't think it's like as deep as you are saying it is, but I think that the movie, the way it's made, you could make it as fucking deep as you
Right,
want.
right, right, right. No, absolutely. I mean, I always privilege the reading of however you want to read it. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's actually what the director's thinking. But
Right.
I do think there is an interesting thing in this movie where there's a detective character played by William Hurt who has a accordion, and we see him playing with it, and we see him tuning it, and we see him. He talks about that his mother gave it to him, but he doesn't remember his mother giving it to him, and that's weird to him. So I think there is something to that. Like,
Yes.
yeah.
One of my very, very favorite shots of this movie is the first time we see him, the camera goes over his accordion. And his
Yeah.
accordion almost looks like the fucking city itself, like as you're like looking right into it, and it's this very
Yeah.
detailed instrument, right? So it's a super exciting shot. And being high, I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. I know that when Alex Proyas was first starting to develop the story, he made it about a detective trying to solve this murder. And so William Hurt's character, Frank Bumstead, he
Yeah.
was, I think, the main character. And then as Alex Proyas kept making the story or developing it, then he wanted to be about multiple characters, give you multiple perspectives. And he was more intrigued by the idea of like this person who could have potentially been a murderer, but wasn't, you
Right,
know?
right, right. Yeah.
And so going back to what you're saying about like the accordion and music, it's a quirky little touch. And I think that like when you're making a genre thing, you're like, okay, well, this person's filling a specific role. He's this detective. You need a detective in a noir scenario. You either need like a regular cop or a private eye. And it's like, well, how do we make them quirky? And I think that that's probably where the accordion comes in. I keep kind of making it seem like Alex Proyas isn't as deep as he might be, you know?
It might not be, it could just be my reading of it.
Right.
So as much as the movie explains stuff, and I've said I think it explains maybe a little too much,
Right.
what's great is a lot is still left open. So I just have a little list here of things that I just want to throw them at you. You don't have to go through them one by one, but I just want to, because this is what I saw. I watched it twice this week. Not high. But by the way, these are the types of movies that are perfect for watching high. Like I was high when I first saw Existence. Okay, why do the aliens dislike water, yet there's water everywhere? What is their objective with the experiment? Kiefer Sutherland says that they're looking for the human soul, but they even make clear in the movie that that's his interpretation of what they're doing. At one point, the aliens say, "We need to be like you to. We're dying. We need to be like you to survive." But I don't know if that makes sense. They also say two contradictory things. They say that they go through and they take people's memories and they swap them. But then we see Kiefer Sutherland creating fake memories and fake personalities, which is what happened with the lead character. Like this idea they wanted for whatever their experiment is to have a killer. So that was a completely false world. There's no real person that's the person th that is. They wanted to create that. So do they switch people's personalities? Do they make new personalities? And what's the point? What are they really trying to get from this thing that they call an experiment? Like, what are they really after? Why would changing the buildings and everything, mean anything? And I'm not necessarily asking you that, but I just like that that's a question that you walk away from. Because it's almost like a dream. I like when something seems to make sense, and then when you think more about it, you're like, wait, that actually doesn't make sense. Like you're like, okay, yeah, go on.
No, I mean, you bring up all these great points to kind of touch upon, and I think it goes along with the idea that I keep kind of driving home, which is I think that like the style is what trumps the substance of this, right? And I know that Alex Proyas, another influence besides the noir look, the aesthetic, is the Twilight Zone was an influence,
Sure.
right? Now, with the Twilight Zone just in general and movies like this in general, it's so much more exciting to the audience to not know what's going on and then piece by piece start to put the picture together, like you said, a puzzle before. And I think that there's like a really, really intriguing, exciting idea in this movie that would make a basis for a Twilight Zone episode,
Oh,
which
yeah.
is if you take a character personality and you put it on a human, or if you take the memories of one person and put them into another person, how are they going to respond? Is there
Interesting.
something innate within us humans? And I think that what they're getting at is like our souls are innate. So like you could change our all of our circumstances, the literal environment that we live in, you could change
Yeah.
all that, and you could change our identity, but are we going to act a certain way because of what we are inside, our soul? And I actually think that the movie doesn't really go further with that idea, even though that in itself is like a movie right there.
Interesting.
Like
Yeah.
that's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess I haven't thought about it like that. Yeah. I mean, I
Yeah.
guess if
You
that's
need it to be high, you know?
if yeah, I know, really. If the soul, it's interesting because like there's some sci-fi that, or some even just some ways of just conceptualizing consciousness where memory is consciousness. They're one and the same. But this would imply differently. And I guess that is kind of what they're saying because he seems to still want to be with the woman that he thought was his wife, even though they weren't really married and didn't really have a history.
Right.
So maybe him wanting her, but that's another big question that we have like a quick answer for, which is, oh, he's evolved. But why is the
Is he
main
evolved?
character, yeah, why is the main character suddenly someone who can do what the aliens do and
Right.
doesn't fall asleep when they put everyone else to sleep? Even
Right.
they're kind of like, who is this guy? How's this guy able to tune? And he's so
Right.
powerful. It sort of ends with like a big, almost like wizard battle between
Yes.
Mr. Book and the main character, where they're like using their like psychic powers at each other.
The movie is like at least three different big ideas together, but it's probably even
Oh,
more than
yeah.
that. But one is the stuff I just said about like swapping people's identities, and that's one thing I want to talk about more in depth is how they literally change the world around people, and they change the people themselves. They replace people. There's the same role, but you'll have like a different person in that place. And that in itself really goes along with the filmmaking allegory, right?
Yeah.
But then there's also this sort of like, oh, this guy is the one, which people always compare this to the Matrix. They say the
Sure.
Matrix ripped this movie off. And one thing as a little side note is that like they literally used sets from this movie for the Matrix too.
Wow.
Like the Matrix was filmed in the same studio as this movie, and they had leftover sets and they used some of it for the Matrix. And it visually it's
Wow.
very similar to
Oh,
the
yeah.
noir setting of the Matrix. But it does kind of become this sort of like superhero wizard kind of epic
Yeah.
battle. It becomes like a Matrix with Neo or like Star Wars, where it's like the chosen one that has this special power by the end.
Yeah.
But the thing that gets you to that point is this idea of like swapping people out or changing people's environments and see how it like affects them, but they don't really go any further with that. You know what I'm
Yeah.
saying?
Yeah.
Because there are literal parts where, okay, let me just give you an example. Rufus Sewell, he's in a hotel room in the beginning of the movie, and there's a guy at the front desk, right? And the guy says a certain thing, and he has this kind of contentious interaction with Rufus Sewell.
Yeah.
And then we see that guy later on, and he's running a newsstand. And that's just to set up Rufus Sewell being like, well, what just happened? I know this guy from this place.
Yeah.
But like, people will say the same lines of dialogue, but they'll be different characters. They've been
Right.
swapped by strangers. And that in itself is just, that's so fucking interesting. But it doesn't really go any deeper than that. It's just to set up that you're like, oh, you're in a fabrication. You know what I'm
Right.
saying?
Yeah, but it is interesting because it would imply that memory or not, setting or not, the guy has the same turn of phrase that he uses both in both personalities. So there must be something inherent to him.
Right. Because the strangers themselves would work if they were machines. Like if it was like the Matrix and they were just
Yeah.
robots, it would work. But because of the style of the movie, there are these kind of quirky things. Like Mr. Hand, he kind of talks in this way. And the other strangers talk this way too, but he does it the most, where like he'll say something and it always sounds like a question when he's saying
Yeah.
something. And then he'll even say yes at the end with a question mark. He'll be like, you know, you're in the swimming pool, yes, like
Yeah, yeah,
that.
yeah, yeah.
And so it's a much more, like you said before, like fairy tale kind of feel. But they could have easily been like just fucking like robots doing experiments on people, or
Oh,
like
yeah.
or emotionless aliens doing experiments, but they're these weird kind of quirky creatures.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. God, there's so much to chew on. We could talk about it for 9 more hours.
Well, I mean, what I really hope that you and I can talk about that scene where they take that couple that's in a small apartment and they're dressed a certain way and they're saying things, and then they just fucking change their apartment to
Yeah,
where it's
let's
like a
talk about it right
mansion.
now.
Well, okay, so just I'm talking a lot. Why don't you tell me what you thought of that sequence? Because that sequence just blew my mind.
So it's there the because it this is one of the only times they talk about class in this movie. You see this two this couple, they're a white couple. They're sitting at a small dining room table, and he's got on like a t-shirt, and they kind of look like lower working class or whatever. And he's talking about his boss, Fredrickson, and he's like, "Yeah, he might give me a shift off next week, blah blah." And then the tuning starts, and they fall asleep. They fall asleep into their like soups, which is an interesting visual. And then Kiefer Sutherland comes in, and he implants in them different personalities. And but while he's doing that, the tuning is happening, and like their house is getting bigger and fancier. Their table is getting longer, right? The food is getting fancier. This is actually good visual effects, like the way like the food, I mean good CGI, I should say, the way like the food appears and stuff, their clothing changes. I kind of read this a little bit as an homage to the montage in Citizen Kane, where they show the deterioration of a wedding, of a marriage, where in the beginning they're sitting really close to each other, and then by the end they're like the giant table in between them. And then when the tuning's over, like they show the couple again, and he's like, I told Fredrickson he could have the week off. So like all of a sudden this guy Fredrickson is beneath who they are, and now the couple is wealthy. It's so interesting to see that like they're not just playing with personalities and memories, they're playing with like how would you act if your class was different? How would you act if you were the boss instead of the employee? And it's just all just visually really rich, that whole sequence. It's like a really like microcosmic way of showing what tuning can be.
Right. It's like if what Roger Ebert said is true, that like it's the idea of like these sort of outsiders, the strangers, looking in on what they think is like filmmaking, right? Or like this is what they kind of think like humans are or whatever, right? What do you call it? Like I've seen this before in sci-fi where like aliens, like Galaxy Quest is a good example, right? Where they make the ship and like they dress the way the crew dresses and stuff, right? They're like, oh, we've seen this. We know what it's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to feel, but they're so off, right? They don't know what the actual reality is. And the movie's kind of summed up at the end with Rufus Sewell after they have that big wizard battle where he says, like, you guys were looking for answers, but you were looking in here, and he points to his head, but he's like, you should have been looking somewhere else. I can't remember if he like points to his
He
heart.
doesn't point to his heart. Because I remember thinking if he points to his heart, this is gonna be too on the nose. Because he does it. He just goes, "You were looking in the wrong place," and he points to his head, which is interesting.
So I mean, like, and just to kind of go along with it, like, and I keep comparing it to other things, but like, Westworld, the modern show of Westworld is a very, very good example where they'll like make all the hosts, that's what they call the robots, like go off. It's actually very similar to Dark City, and then they like will replace a host, and the host will say the exact same line or do the exact same thing as the previous host, but there'll be like a slight difference in their inflection and stuff. So it's very similar to that. It's like the humans in it are almost like robots in Dark City, where it's like you're just changing the programming, but it's the same like model, you know?
No, exactly. There's something very humanist about it, I think. It ends in a very like love and sunlight is magical kind of a way. It's a very up ending.
Because I think that like they do, I think they do say the fucking word soul a couple of times in the
Oh yeah,
movie,
for sure.
and one of the reasons why it's much more like the Matrix than you might think is because I think ultimately it's about like free will, because Murdoch, the main guy, John Murdoch, he's like Neo in the movie, and like they're very similar in the way they go about things and stuff like that in the movie, and at the very end he is like Neo too, where he can like literally
Move
control the
things.
environment around. And he goes toe to toe with like the main bad guy too,
It's
and
a
they're
lot
like,
like Matrix in
cool.
that way.
But I think that like soul and identity and free will, they're the major things they focus on in this movie, and it's that's why it's just like the Matrix too, you know?
It's also got that thing that I think it's big now, but it was also be starting to get big in the 90s, which is like, wake up, sheeple. Like this almost masculine fantasy of like, you're gonna wake up and you're gonna be powerful. It's even though it's not about a virtual world, in some ways I think Fight Club speaks to this stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, I think I've said this on your show before. I think I even said this on the last time I was on your episode, your show, which I think we did talk about the Matrix on your show, and then we referenced Dark City, which is that like pre-9/11, there's a lot of things where it's like you're being controlled, you're being manipulated. It's time for you to wake up. In the Matrix, they literally play the song "Wake Up" by Rage Against the
I think
Machine
we
at
were
the very
talking
end,
about
right?
Vanilla Sky, which is a similar, another similar thing.
We talked. Well, I think we've done this a couple of times now in a row. You know, maybe we should just make our own podcast about this subject, right? But like we did Vanilla Sky, and then we did the movies that blow your mind,
Oh,
and
right.
we talked about the Matrix and Fight Club, where
Yes,
it
yes,
is this
yes.
idea of like you're being controlled by these external forces, which literally shape the world, which is like Dark City to a T. And then the Matrix and Fight Club are much more like you're going to take power because of who you are. Dark City, like as powerful as Murdoch is at the very end, it doesn't feel like he's going to go on some kind of crusade or be a hero at the end. It feels like he might not even like wake up other people or like tell other people the truth of this world. He might just go do his own
He's
thing,
gonna let them
you
have
know?
free will, I think. Going back to what you're saying, I think that's a big thing.
Right.
He's gonna let them go to the beach. He creates a sun, so they're sun now, so they can have. So I think he's just gonna allow them to naturally do whatever they want to do,
Yeah.
until they die.
Yeah. Can we talk about William Hurt for a couple minutes?
Yes, but we have to be
Okay,
careful
so
about William Hurt though. Because we found out after his death that he was not a good person, although a good performer.
oh, okay. Well,
He's
that's
great in
interesting.
this
I didn't
movie.
even.
He is a fantastic. Here's my favorite line in this movie where he's like, stop, don't go. And then the main character runs away and he goes, no one ever listens to me.
Yes. No, he's great in this. He plays that hard-boiled detective
Yeah,
who has
perfect.
these little sarcastic lines. That's interesting. I didn't know anything about William Hurt being controversial. I didn't know anything about that. But I've always been like, I've never really liked him. Like I'm like, oh, William Hurt, he's exciting, he's fun. But I've always been impressed with his acting ability. You know?
He
He
does this
he's like.
thing where he like underperforms. He like very, very
Yes.
subtle.
Right. And he's kind of his voice is kind of monotone too. It's like right, you know. It's perfect for the role in this movie. And I could see why he might have been the original main character in the early conception of this movie. When he dies, I remember that was like very shocking and kind of upsetting when it happens. And it's in this cool, it's in the when the big picture is finally revealed, that's when he dies.
And it's interesting that he, what I think is interesting about his character is he's not like the main character where he can tune and stuff, but just because he's smart, he's on to what's happening. He's just
Right.
beginning as a detective to be like, these things aren't all making sense, which I like that idea that someone could just be smart enough to get out of it. You know, it's like there's that animatrix. And then we did a whole thing on this show about the Matrix, but the animatrix animated short where the guy's like a great runner and is in this marathon and runs so fast he runs out of the Matrix. Like just his human ability makes him able to break it.
Yeah.
Oh, what was I gonna say? Have you ever seen A History of Violence?
Of course, of course.
He's great in that as the very small role at the very end as the evil like brother. It's such a good
Yep.
performance because he's like, oh, my brother, I'm so happy to see you. But it's also, he's constantly menacing him. And like, you know, he wants to kill him, but he's also like pretending to be happy to see him.
No, this movie, like we keep talking about genre, but I think that this movie is in a subgenre. You know, I think that like you could put it in the same subgenre as The Matrix, maybe Fight Club, but I think definitely The Matrix, where it's like there's something going on, you don't know what it is, but the main character is going to find out what it is. Like the reality is an illusion subgenre. And I think that there's always this one character too that is aware before the main character, and they seem like a crazy person. And so I really like that Frank Bumstead, William Hurt's character, had a partner who was a detective, but that detective's gone over the deep end. And we go to his apartment and we see how much the detective is bothering his wife. Like, his wife is so sad because of how crazy he's gotten. And then we find his room. And I think, like, always, like, a kind of a cliche for this character is they always have like scrawlings on the wall and stuff and all kinds of crazy notes. And I mean, that happens exactly in this movie. And that guy, like, he tells you stuff where you're like, in when you watch it later, you're like, oh, okay, I know exactly what he's saying. This all makes sense. And he's like, this has all happened before. I'm not really here. I'm not really this guy. And then his way of getting out of it is he jumps in front of a
Yeah,
train,
it's crazy. He's like, oh, I figured out a way out of it, and he just kills himself, which is, it's crazy. It's true in a sense. But we
I
could
just.
go all day. We got to wrap this one up.
Oh, sorry.
No, we could go all day with the philosophical shit. We haven't even talked about Bertrand Russell and Last Thursdayism and all that stuff. But Peter, tell us a little bit about your output.
Stuff that I make. I got my two channels. I got Comic Books Transformed, and I got the LasserCast. On the LasserCast, we just did this recording. I think if you like Mike's show, guys, then you'll like this recording we did on Superman 3, specifically the robot woman that's at the end of 3. LasserCast is a horror show, and so we're always talking about horror streaming shows or movies. Then on Comic Books Transformed, me and my friend Brian talk about streaming shows or movies that are based on comics. Mike was just on there. You were just on there for Superman
Yes, if
2025,
you want to hear
and
me, my take on Superman 2025, go listen to it. Or go watch it on Comic Book Transformed.
a really great episode. I mean, if you guys didn't get bored by me talking, please check out my there's podcasts on Spotify, then there's the two channels on YouTube too, so give us a shot.
Thank you so much, Peter. We end every episode by saying,
Go bye-bye.